Good day. I'm Warren Thompson, and welcome to this week's edition of Click & Advisor. Joining me on the show today is Charles Botha. He is from Future Wealth Portfolio Management. And as opposed to being an advisor, he's actually more a portfolio manager. So good to have you with us, Charles.
Thanks, Warren. Thanks for having me.
Just tell us a little bit about your business. You are actually running what we call segregated accounts for small caps, investing in small caps. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So I don't have my own financial license. So I'm actually on the FSP license of a company called Lentus Asset Management. Right. And so they do all my back office and so on. So I get all the time to read and research shares. And I sort of design the Future Wealth portfolio, which gets replicated for each person that joins the portfolio.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about some of the metrics around what you invest in. You're investing in small caps, and give us an idea of the size and the amount of stocks that you'd run in this model portfolio.
Yes,
the size in terms of the market cap of the companies involved.
I hear you. So just first off, I am size and style agnostic, but most of the stocks in the portfolio is small cap, what you'd traditionally call small cap. The reason for that is mathematical. So I see that small companies can grow faster and become bigger than the equivalent big caps. And also there's much more room for growth for them to become 10 baggers or 5 baggers or whatever. And then also, so the market caps you would see in my fund range from about 300 million to 4 billion, around about. But I also have Steinhoff in the portfolio, which is obviously a very large cap.
Okay, so what is the criteria for including a stock in your model portfolio?
Okay, so the first thing I look at is I want to see top-line growth. So I want to see people demanding the services or goods of this company. And top-line growth faster than inflation. So in other words, real growth faster than the economy.
So their revenue's got to grow faster than our inflation.
Yes, plus our real growth. So our real growth is quite low now, but let's say South Africa's potential GDP is around 2 or 3, so add inflation of 6 to that. So I'm looking for a company that can grow revenues faster than 10.
Okay.
It doesn't help you just grow revenues and using a massive amounts of assets to do that. So I'm looking at how efficiently or effectively the company can use its assets. So return on capital, which you can define in various ways, but let's say return on equity or return on capital employed or return on invested capital, those type of things. So those are the two most important metrics I use. And then I also like to look at the stability of the margins. And then I just try and understand how the company makes money, which is very important.
How many businesses are in your model portfolio at the moment?
At the moment, I only have 8. So my take on portfolio management is, like Warren Buffett says, I don't want a zoo. I don't have time to understand, 70, 80 businesses. So I've got fewer businesses, which I try to follow more closely. So more concentrated bets.
And how are those distributed in the portfolio? Do they come in at a fairly standard size, or do they come in small and you build them up in terms of the percentage size in the portfolio?
Yeah. So if something can't be around 4% in my portfolio, I don't include it. So it must at least be a 4% bet for me. If I really really like something, and I'm really sure about the metrics and the price I pay, it could go as high as even 20%, which is quite abnormal in the professional money management business. But that's the way I go about it.
Is anyone at 20% or greater at the moment?
Yes. So Rolf's Chemicals and actually Master Drilling, two companies I've written about on MoneyWeb quite often. These are two businesses which I think still have a lot of legs, and like the management, like the metrics. And a funny thing is, a lot of people ask me, okay, but small caps are quite risky. So what about, why don't you invest in the so-called blue chips or top 40 shares? And I would say the following. So I think Rolf's, for instance, is a lot less risky than something like Kumba or Anglerplat. Because Rolfs, whereas Anglerplats and Kumba have single commodities and they're exposed to the vagaries of these international commodity prices, Rolfs has got four different businesses and hundreds of different clients and in different sectors of the chemical market. Rolfs is a specialty chemicals company.
Okay.
Yeah, so they've got food chemicals, industrial chemicals, agricultural chemicals, and water chemicals, and each one of those, they don't only sell in South Africa, they sell in Africa, they sell in the United States, they sell in Europe, and none of these guys make up a significant percentage of the revenue. So, for instance, if one big client drops out, that's not a problem. Whereas Kumba, if some people in China slow down on steel, we've seen what happens.
Okay, so you're thinking about risk in quite a different way.
Yes.
If I've understood you correctly, you've made reference to the margin, making sure margins in a business stay stable, as well as growth. So for that reason, when I asked you off air if you're more a value investor or a growth investor for those people that have read Peter Lynch's books, you're using quite a different set of metrics or opposing set of metrics, one would say, when you try and pigeonhole the style of the investing.
It's very interesting that you mentioned Peter Lynch because I've learned a lot from him, and I really recommend these books to all our listeners. Very fun to read. So I don't like pigeonholing from above, so to speak. So what I would say is I try and buy a growth company at a value price. So that's the holy grail for me. If I can get a company that grows double digits and I can buy it on a single P, one must be careful of using one metric, but that's just an example. So if I can do that, then I'm very happy. So I don't just want to buy something that's not going anywhere for a very good price. I want to buy something that grows at a good price.
I think if I remember correctly, Peter Lynch uses something called the PEG ratio.
Yes.
Perhaps you can explain that for investors, to the uninitiated, what the PEG ratio is.
Yes.
Because it's quite a nice way, quite a quick rule of thumb to see whether it would fit. Yes. I think what you're talking about with companies that are growing faster than what their price indicates.
Yes, so the PEG ratio, it's quite simple. So you take the PE, so let's say the PE of a business is 10.
That's the price-earnings ratio.
Yes, price-earnings ratio, yes. That's 10, you'll see in the newspaper, on MoneyWeb, etc. And then you take the growth rate in earnings, the bottom line earnings, so profit after tax, and that will be a certain growth rate. So I like taking it over a five-year period, so that sort of evens out the cycles of the business. And then if you take the PE on top, numerator, and you divide the growth rate, the denominator, so let's say it grows at 10%, the PE is at 10%, so that'll give you a PEG of 1.
Yeah.
So if you find a business, let me just get it right now. So if you find a business at a PEG of less than 1, I think, that's good. That's a good thing. I always mix up the two.
Yes. so let's just do this as a very simple calculation. There's a share price. A company earned earnings per share of 1 rand in the last financial year. The share price is at 10.
Yes.
So the PE ratio is 10.
That's correct.
Okay. So we put that 10 divided by what you think will be the, do you look back and say what the historical
earnings growth has been? Yes, yeah, so I look back first of all, because that'll give you sort of a baseline. Otherwise, you're just plucking numbers from the air. So then I'd say, okay, this business has managed over the last 5 years to grow at an average of, let's say, 10%. And then this year, maybe I've spoken to management or I've read somewhere and I see, yes, it's looking very good for this year. Maybe they're going to grow 20%. Right, and so then you've got the 10 divided by 20, which is 0.5, which is excellent. So anything under 1 is excellent. I just want to mention one caveat with the PEG ratio. And this is more technical, but I think it's very important. So the PEG ratio is very good for this type of, you know, low price paid and good growth to find these companies. But you must just check one other thing. You must check the level of return on capital. So the PEG ratio doesn't take that into account.
Right.
So one must just keep an eye out. So rule of thumb, ROE is above 15, return on capital employed above 10. Rule of thumb, that should be great. Just check that.
So you use that return on capital because obviously a business that injects more debt into its capital structure could grow faster, but its returns on its capital might be lower, because a return on capital assumes that you're looking at something like a profit divided by the total capital employed in the business, which would include the equity and the debt.
Yes, you're right. So return on equity only includes the equity part, our part as shareholders, and return on capital employed or return on invested capital is more the what you'd call the weighted capital. So you'll see that if you read a technical article or some of my articles, I use something called the WACC. The WACC is the weighted average cost of capital. So that's very, very simply, it's just the mixture of the capital that you use, the cost of that, your cost to use that. Yes.
Okay, great. Just coming back, let's just talk about a few of the challenges of investing in small caps. There are a couple that are very obvious, like liquidity, being able to buy and sell the shares in the volumes that you need them. Just take us through a couple of the challenges that you've identified when you invest in small caps in particular.
Yeah, sure. So I'm fortunate or unfortunate. I know my fund's not that big, so I can move in and out of the shares I'm looking at quite comfortably. So I think somebody like Keith McLachlan, he would have a little bit more problems with that because his fund's bigger. So that's definitely a problem, because the reason, if you wanted to buy a significant stake in one of these companies, you can drive up the price if you're impatient. Also, the other thing is small caps, what I found, and this is just anecdotal, is small caps tend to move around news flow events. So it might be many months where nothing happens to the share price and retail investors maybe can get a little bit impatient and sell out because it's not, you know, exciting enough. But so small caps move around news flow events and one must be patient. So it's not you need patience in shares, but you need even more patience in small caps.
When you say news flow, what exactly are you referring to there?
So those will be, let's say, interim results, 6-monthly results,
right,
or 12-monthly results, trading statements. Also, let's say, new technology that the business has developed. For instance, like Master Drilling recently unveiling horizontal boring technology at the mining in Durban, which is a big deal since they've only been able to drill vertically for clients. Up to this stage. So horizontal applications of their technologies is a big deal for them.
Okay, that's a very interesting company as well, because another thing, and it's becoming more and more, I guess, of the older idea or a legacy idea around small caps, is that they're usually very domestically focused. In other words, they have a big exposure to the South African economy and very little revenue and profits coming from offshore. How do you see that at the moment?
I think people, that's a good point you raise, and you'll be surprised how much money these smaller companies make overseas. For instance, Master Drilling, the financial reporting is actually done in dollars, because most of their money is made in dollars, their contracts are in dollars. So they're very big in South America, they're very big in the rest of Africa. They're also moving into the United States in a big way, Mexico and more North America, and then they've got a presence in Africa, but it's not insignificant, but it's smaller than the foreign exposure. The same with another company I like, Centova, Consolidated Infrastructure Group. Recently, I think that it's 60% revenue outside South Africa.
That much?
Yes. So one would, you know, you think of the classic Rand hedges that everybody talks about, you know, your British American Tobaccos, your SAB Millers that used to be. But you actually get Rand hedges in the smaller companies as well, so people mustn't forget that.
Just take us through a little bit about the governance. Obviously, the fact that many companies are small cap would suggest that there might be the presence of the entrepreneur or the founder of the business in that company. When these entrepreneurs start an undertaking moving their company to a public format where they list on the JSE, for instance, how do they undertake governance? Because it's quite a different animal when you're an entrepreneur running your private business. you're basically like a dictator. You make all the decisions, you do what you want. When you become a public company, it imposes responsibilities and standards and conditions on them around how the board is formulated and how the business is governed. How are these small businesses doing in that respect?
Look, it's a good point you raise, very good point. And as investors, we stand outside the company. So I'm not in a board meeting and things like that. So one obviously has an informational disadvantage. But what I try and do is I want to see how the board is composed. So let's see maybe an ex-businessman that's got respect and people in the industry. I like to see that the board is not just a bunch of well-known names, but he's actually the entrepreneur, or his family has actually picked the board well. So people that can help him to professionalize the business. So for an example, I'll give you an example. So Rolf's, I think it was last year or the year before, no, 2015, they bought a company, a food chemicals company called Bragan. And Bragan's been a real game changer to them. And they bought Bragan from a couple, Craig and Jill Taylor, for 200 odd million. And Craig and his wife stayed on. And Lizette, the CEO of Rolf's, told me, so the company was great. It was doing very nicely. But they had to professionalize some of the reporting systems, some of the structures within the business to be able to take it to the next level. So there's nothing wrong with the business that Craig and Jill did. It just to bring it into a listed environment and to grow it, they needed to add one or two managers, and they needed to up their reporting. So the composition of the board, and to trace the history a bit. So Google is very nice for that, and just see who the guys are and speak to people in the industry. That's what I do.
Are there any red flags in that respect? Operator doesn't have any big financial incentive. So there's no skin in the game, basically.
Yeah, there's no skin in the game. And also, it's a difficult question to answer because I've done it a lot and I see it. I know when I see it, but it's difficult to describe to you exactly what I see. So maybe the way he writes the report, the sort of information he adds, the sort of style he speaks with when he's doing interviews, the things you hear about him from other people. It's sort of you try and create a mosaic of the management team. And obviously you can be wrong. And that's why you can make mistakes with people. And I recently did make a mistake with a company that's been in the news regarding the grants payments. So you do make mistakes. But you try as best you can to build a circumstantial case, a circumstantial evidence case for these guys are good managers, they take care of shareholders, these guys aren't, and so on.
Okay, so I mean, and it's because of that informational
divergence.
Yeah, yes. Disadvantage, yes. That you've spoken about. Okay, yes. Great. Let's have a chat. So you've mentioned Master Drilling. They've done that horizontal raise boring, I think they call it. Consolidated Infrastructure Group. Tell us a little bit about that business. The last I heard, they had bought a business in Angola, an oil services business. I think they were servicing the oil rigs off the coast of Luanda there. What attracts you to CIG at the moment?
Yes, so I am quite active on Twitter, and there's Keith McLachlan and Anthony Clark. Our listeners will know them well. So I follow them, and we speak quite a bit on Twitter, and they've liked this company for quite a while. So as people know, Anthony has always got his top five each year, and he's included SIL, or Consolidated Infrastructure Group, in the top five for quite a while. And I was just a little bit skeptical of it because it's a projects-based business.
Right.
And because you're a projects-based business, you've got lumpy revenue and lumpy earnings. And in Africa, as we all know, maybe getting paid is one of the bigger risks you have. So even though the business had great metrics, on my revenue metric it did very well, the cash flow, it requires quite a bit of cash flow to finance these projects. And so I took a more in-depth look, and especially after they bought a business called Conlog last year. So you were talking about AES, the oil services business. Fantastic business. They do they service all the oil majors off the coast, the waste products from from the oil drilling business. And then, but ConLog, coming back to that, it's a different sort of business from the rest of their portfolio. So ConLog is a much more capital light, non-projects-based business, so it's highly cash generative. So what that did is it changed the profile of the bigger group, the bigger consolidated infrastructure group for me, and de-risk the business quite a bit. And so I recently wrote an article on that on MoneyWeb, which you can go and check out. And I think that's actually a fantastic business with a lot of top-line opportunity for growth, given Africa's lag in power and other infrastructure spend.
Obviously had a very rocky 2 weeks in South Africa from a political side of things. How have small caps behaved in that period? And how do you see the valuations on some of these companies on the JSE? Have they been, has the market presented you with more buying opportunities or less since Pravin Gordhan was recalled from London?
So I'm like a kid in a candy store at the moment, except my mom doesn't want to give me money. So now there's lots of opportunities now. So the valuations on some of the stocks that I've mentioned, Rolfs, Centova, Adapt IT, we haven't spoken about, Consolidated Infrastructure Group. If you can ignore the noise around the political sphere, etc., I think you'll do very well in the next 3 to 5 years buying these companies.
With Charles Boerter, portfolio manager with Future Wealth Portfolio Management.